Happy New Year, everyone. And as we've done on many, many, many New Year's days, we're going to take a look at birds here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. And we'll zero in a little bit on bird conservation efforts. Couple guests for you today. Craig Thompson of La Crosse chairs the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative International Committee. He's a regional land program supervisor with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And I believe, Craig, you there?
I am here, Larry. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Great to have you with us. Noel Cutright with us as well from Ozaukee County. He's former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And certainly, Noel, as always, a pleasure to welcome you. Thanks for being with us today and Happy New Year.
Well, it's a great pleasure, and a Happy New Year to you and to Craig and to all the listeners out there.
And I'll tell you what, if you'd like to join in, maybe have a question for Craig or Noel, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Noel, you and your son had a target of 12 Christmas bird counts this year. Were you able to meet that goal?
Well, we came very close. We have one more to go this coming week up in Florence, Wisconsin, which is always one of my favorites. I started it several years ago, and now Kay Cavanaugh coordinates it. My son and I are driving up for it. We were snowed out, winded out last Sunday. My son coordinates a count up in Rosendale, up in Fond du Lac County, and it was just too hazardous to venture out, but all the others, we did Cassville this a couple of days ago out on the Mississippi River, up in Kickapoo area, up in the Nisida area, and of course around here in southeastern Wisconsin, we went on several. So we've really been doing well, but we missed one so far.
Well, that's not too bad. That's not too bad at all. Craig, you know, the more than half of Wisconsin's breeding birds, what do we have, 238, is it, species of breeding birds? Spend the winter in the tropics of Latin America. And so that has a big impact on our bird life, where they spend their winters.
Well, that's exactly right, Larry. I think the birds have it figured out. Actually, I'd like to be down there with them right now, especially today. And the birds that Noel is seeing on his Christmas bird counts are species that are typically considered either be residents or short-distance migrants. But as you had mentioned, more than half of Wisconsin species of birds migrate down to the tropics every year, and they're just not tough enough to make it through Wisconsin's winters, and so they go down to Latin America and South America and spend the winter. In fact, they spend perhaps up to 6 months of their entire annual cycle in Latin America. And so traditionally, those birds that we think of as ours are actually more Latin American in terms of their origins and affinities than they really are Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And so when we look at conservation for those species, we need to take a hemispheric perspective for them.
Yeah, for sure. And you chair the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative's International Committee. Let's talk about the initiative and the International Committee a little bit.
The Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative is a terrific effort. It's an umbrella organization of more than 160 partner organizations which are working on behalf of bird conservation in Wisconsin. We have a coordinator for the effort. His name is Andy Polios. He just does a terrific job. And it's a very tough job. It's, you know, akin to herding cats, actually.
Yeah.
And the member organizations range from corporations to birding clubs to state and federal agencies. And the intent is to provide integrated, coordinated bird conservation efforts to really for two reasons: to keep common species common, and that's one of the things we often overlook, and then also to conserve and restore endangered, threatened, and rare bird species that occur in Wisconsin. And it's been underway since the late 1990s, and I think we're realizing some tremendous success. It's a terrific effort. I'm happy to be a part of it.
That's great news that you're doing that kind of work. And Noel, just kick back to you for a second. How did the bird counts go for you?
I think it went really well. As every year, there's certain trends that you see. Some of these trends are larger numbers of certain species. For example, this year we're seeing really good numbers of blue jays and northern shrikes, which is a species that doesn't even breed in Wisconsin but comes down here in the wintertime. And then other species are down in numbers. We're not seeing many pine siskins this year. So every year is different. And of course, that's why we've been doing Christmas bird counts now for over 100 years, to try to monitor midwinter populations of some of these species, because here in Wisconsin we do over 100 of these counts over about a 3-week period from mid-December into January 5th. And because of this good coverage in the state, we can really document some of the trends, ups and downs, and trying to sort out the reasons why.
We get a call from Jane in Madison who wants to know about habitat protection for cranes in Wisconsin and Nebraska. And probably both of you could comment, but Craig, you want to take a shot at that first?
Well, cranes are typically a species that nests in wetlands, and so Wisconsin has some of the stronger wetland protection regulations in the state, and I think we're doing a pretty good job of, actually a very good job of protecting and managing Wisconsin's wetlands on behalf of cranes, and that's why we have good numbers of crane sandhill cranes in the state, and of course there are whooping cranes that have been reintroduced now, and they're doing well. And so what we need to do is make sure that we have wetlands protected on the breeding grounds, wetlands protected on their wintering grounds down in the southern United States, and also ensure that there are adequate stopover sites, that is, wetlands that the birds can stop in on their migratory journey so they have the opportunity to rest and refuel as they head either north to their breeding grounds in Wisconsin or associated states or south to their wintering grounds in Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and so on.
Yeah, I took a look at the International Crane Foundation website. I think the last entry I saw was December 22nd, but they're tracking and monitoring 59 hoopers in the eastern population, and they're currently scattered, I believe, across Indiana and Tennessee and Alabama and Florida, South Carolina, maybe Georgia, I don't know.
Yeah, they're all over the place, and I think what we're finding is we're realizing some success with instilling migratory tendencies in this species, although the fact that they have a tendency to wander indicates that it's perhaps the site fidelity, that inclination to go to the sites that we want them to go, that we want them to go to, or is not necessarily as strong as we'd like it to be. Nonetheless, the program has been very successful, and we're delighted to have whooping cranes back on the landscape in Wisconsin.
Noel, as we look back on 2007, any surprises for you or any really pleasant surprises for you in the bird life here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think the highlight for 2007 was discovering Kirtland's warblers breeding in the state. This is a species that, as far as recorded time, have only bred in the northern part of the lower peninsula of Michigan. And they head southeast to overwinter on the Bermuda Islands off the coast of Florida, and then they return to Michigan every year and breed in jack pine habitats. And over the years, we've had a few males that have returned or tried to explore new areas and have turned up in Wisconsin. We've never had a female recorded in the state until this year, and we have nesting of this species in the state. And it's going to be really interesting coming up in 2008 to see if these birds return, how many. We start tracking them. It's a federally endangered species. To have them nesting in the state was just an amazing. We hope to do that during the Atlas, find them during the Breeding Bird Atlas, because we had some males show up, but not any females, and actually had nests this year. So I think that was the single biggest highlight for the state for 2007.
And Craig, what about you and your maybe for the state or maybe for your international work? What was your highlight?
The highlight for me last year, Larry, through the international committee, we have been running what we call tropical birdathons, and the intent of the birdathons are to connect birders to conservation. Essentially, we're trying to harness the conservation power of birders. And so, what we do are we set up trips at cost, take birders down to very bird-rich sites in Latin America, and as a result of being able to participate in the trip at cost, each participant has to donate $500 to a conservation organization. Our last trip was in August. We ended up seeing, gee whiz, something like 365 species of birds. It was absolutely unbelievable in a week's time. But I think more importantly, we raised $19,000 to advance bird conservation for a nonprofit conservation organization in northwestern Ecuador. And what they're going to do with the money we raise for them is help buy endangered bird habitat that's highly threatened and critically important. And so our ability to leverage conservation dollars to advance conservation in Latin America, not only for the resident species down there, but also for our neotropical migrants that are there now, gave us a tremendous amount of satisfaction. We're really pleased with that accomplishment.
Oh, you had to be. Terry in Washera has a question or comment. Terry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and guests. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had what I'm calling a Christmas miracle. on Christmas Eve afternoon, I was standing in my kitchen looking out at the bird feeders, and I have a heated bird bath, and there were approximately 6 to 8, both male and female, bluebirds, all fluttering around the water bowl and flying back up into the tree where I have feeders, although I did not see them eating any of the feed. But I have never seen bluebirds this late in the year in Wisconsin. And I'll make another comment, and then I'll hang up and listen if that's all right.
Sure.
Yesterday, I was taking a walk and saw about 2 dozen pine siskins all fluttering around in the tree. Now, this is out in the country, way out in the country, so it's not in a, you know, in a city type of an area.
Yeah.
But I'd love to hear guests' comments on those two sightings.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Noel, you have any records of bluebirds this late?
Oh, yes. It's a definitely a decent bluebird year this year. We seem to have a few that overwinter in the state every year. This year, even though with a heavy snowfall over much of the state, we're seeing pretty good numbers of bluebirds turning up on Christmas counts. Down in the Cassville County, the Mississippi area, we had 17 in our little area that we counted 2 days ago. But overall, it's they're being reported in good numbers. As she mentioned, they will come to especially fruit. We had some on the Kickapoo count, I believe it was, coming into some wild grapes. So crab apples and grapes, and especially bittersweet, American bittersweet, is very good food for bluebirds. And she mentioned pine siskin. That's
yeah.
A good sighting, because in general, pine siskins have been low this year throughout the state, whereas red poles, I just had a number show up at my feeder yesterday, about 20 in Ozaukee County. My wife recently reported just a few minutes ago that at least 6 showed up again this year. So red poles in good numbers, but pine siskins are down in numbers this year.
Interesting. Thanks again for calling. Judy in Gresham, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Judy.
Hello there.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a bird feeder that I've always had plenty of chickadees and finches at. Now, this year, we have sighted the northern shrike in the area. Could that account for the fact that the only one eating my seeds this year is the chipmunk?
Well, I don't know. What do you think, Craig?
I think that probably has an impact, absolutely. Shrikes are a tremendous bird. Noel's picked several of them up on his Christmas bird count. And they are a bird predator, so shrikes key in on small things like chickadees and juncos. And birds have an amazing ability to know when predators are in the neighborhood. We're not fortunate enough to get shrikes at our bird feeder, but we do have a couple of resident Cooper's hawks, which terrorize our yard on a daily basis. And it's interesting because I can take a look out the windows and I'll see tons of birds. I know that the hawks aren't around. And if I go look out the windows and there isn't a bird to be found, there's a hawk somewhere in the neighborhood. So they have the ability to know when those predators are around and they take cover and justify it. So.
We have a Cooper's hawk in our neighborhood, too, that pretty much know whenever that Cooper's hawk's around because the birds are gone. They're gone. Noel, do you have any of that, too?
Absolutely. We have Cooper's hawks that come past every day, and an occasional sharp-shinned hawk, both of those species of accipiter, which are round-winged hawks with a long tail. The sharp chin tend to be smaller than the Cooper's hawk. But both of those will definitely make their rounds of feeders and prey on birds, as will the northern shrike. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a really good year for northern shrikes. I wouldn't be surprised that we set an all-time high record for a number of northern shrikes seen on Christmas bird counts. And they will also prey, especially on the smaller feeder birds. They will not tackle a mourning dove or something like a blue jay, where a Cooper's hawk will.
Yeah. Craig, you were going to say something?
Well, it just seems, it seems that with the advent of as much bird feeding as is going on, Cooper's hawks are wintering very regularly in the state now. And I think that there are so many feeders that it's akin to an all-you-can-eat buffet for these birds. They just come in and basically pluck birds out at will and eat them. And you know, I know some people don't like to see it, but it is the cycle of nature, and they've got to eat, too, and they really are magnificent birds if you get the opportunity to actually take a close look at one.
I may have told this story. This is not this happens to be a story about an eagle, but about a week or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, we live on Lake Monona in Madison, and part of the lake was just a little part of the lake was still open, and there were some geese on the lake, and Some of them were up on the ice, and an eagle came in, and while my wife was watching and daughter, and nabbed a goose and sat down and proceeded to eat quite a bit of that goose. Then the eagle finally left, and some crows came in, and they ate a little bit. And then quite a while later, here my wife looked out, and here was a red fox out and finishing that goose. That goose fed a lot of a lot of wildlife. It was one of those experiences you feel a little sorry for the goose, but hey, everybody's got to eat, I guess.
Absolutely.
It was a National Geographic moment, Larry.
It sure was. I tell you what, Craig Thompson of La Crosse, chairing the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative International Committee, and Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, our guest today as we talk birds and bird conservation. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds and bird conservation efforts on this first day of 2008. Larry Mueller here, glad to have you with us. And Craig Thompson of the Department of Natural Resources and the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative International Committee are one of our guests. Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And we'll turn to Mike in Richland Center next. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you guys.
Happy New Year.
My question is about goldfinches. Prior to the last big Christmas snow we had, I had at least a dozen, maybe some more, goldfinches on my tube of Niger seed. When that snow hit the next morning, the Nigers were not around. They haven't returned since. I had two this morning. That's the first time since the snowstorm. What happened to them? They've been here for years.
Well, they may have taken some cover. Noel, you want to start?
Yeah, the finches tend to wander quite a bit, and it's hard to predict kind of why they're there certain times and aren't there. Overall, goldfinch numbers that we've seen on Christmas counts this year have kind of been weak in number, so it's not a good year. Even though I had breakfast this morning with a birder from Fredonia, and she has 60 goldfinches at her feeder.
Wow.
But she's bemoaning that she has no purple finches and no red poles or pine siskin. I tell her she has too many goldfinches at her feeder. But and in general, the goldfinches seem to be down in number. Why they're there a certain time and disappear, maybe they're finding an alternative food source or more protection in a roosting area. It's just hard to predict, but, of course, that's what makes birding fascinating. Things are always changing. You're always wondering, why did this happen, or why did we see a particular species or behavior happen? It's one of the fascinating things about bird watching that we have to ponder over.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Linda in Colfax has a question, too, so let's go to Linda. Linda, hi. Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to say I'm enjoying the show, and I have a wonderful pair of cardinals that stay year-round, and they're just so much fun. But my comment or question actually is about the Kirkland warbler. I worked once upon a time in the UP, and we did a lot of habitat work to encourage it. I don't know if we ever get Kirkland warblers up there, but now that they're in Wisconsin, I'm curious as to what can be done to provide better habitat.
Habitat? And, Craig, a comment?
Oh, this is a species that is very picky in terms of its habitat preferences. It typically nests in early stands of young jack pine. And what we know that we can manage successfully for that kind of structure on the landscape. So we can actually grow those jack pine forests and manage them appropriately to provide good breeding habitat for Kirtlands. I think what has happened, as Noel had alluded to earlier, is the population in Michigan is experiencing tremendous success in terms of growth. We've been very effective at managing for that species. And as the population gets bigger, juvenile birds are starting to fan out every year and looking for new suitable habitat to colonize. And that's what's happening in Wisconsin and the UP, is they're actually finding these stands that provide the kind of habitat structure that they like, and they're beginning to occupy those stands and to breed in them. And we hope that they will be successful short-term and long-term and establish new breeding colonies. So it's one of the species that we really have been very successful in managing the landscape for, and we hope to continue those activities.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Linda. Appreciate the call. Patricia in Madison, I believe, is next. So let's go to Patricia. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. Happy New Year to you all.
To you as well.
Early last June, I had the opportunity to drive through Peninsula State Park in Door County.
Yep.
And we were wondering why many of the vehicles were slowing down. And alongside the road there was a old tree stump, maybe about 2.5 feet tall, and there was a pileated woodpecker on it. And, of course, we stopped, too, to take a look. I mean, it was just like seeing something unbelievable, the size of that bird. And then as we drove along, another one flew past our windshield. And I was wondering, is that a common habitat area for them?
I would just tell you, Patricia, that my family, Renee and I and Emily, were at Peninsula and saw a pileated mom and dad with two youngsters.
Oh, my.
This past summer. So
it's very exciting, isn't it?
Exciting, really exciting to see. Noel, comment?
Yes, it's definitely a good habitat for them. It's a population, as our woodlands here in Wisconsin mature, and we have more, you know, kind of the shrubby early successional stages evolving into or succeeding into woodlands. We're seeing more and more pileated or pileated woodpeckers showing up. The breeding bird survey shows that they're increasing about 5% per year in Wisconsin. So, and if you look at the Breeding Bird Atlas map, they breed pretty much throughout Wisconsin. There's only a few areas along the Illinois border where there's so much agriculture that they haven't been able to find suitable woodlots yet, but it's a species that should continue to increase in the state as woodlands mature and become more suitable for pileated or pileated woodpeckers.
Craig, did you get a chance to sight some pileated or pileated this year?
Oh, actually, yes. I have the opportunity every spring to go out and do breeding bird surveys, and we always pick up a pair or two depending on the location we're in. But even more exciting than that is the opportunity to see them occasionally in La Crosse. My wife, Mary, and I were walking yesterday, in fact, and we encountered a pileated just a few blocks from downtown, and I think what happens is birds have to range more widely in the winter looking for food. The pileateds come out of the heavily forested hills above La Crosse, and they actually come down into the city and visit some of the big hackberries and ash and silver maples, and it was just a treat to see one a couple of blocks from our home.
Oh, absolutely.
And they'll occasionally come to suet feeders, too, so it's something to keep an eye open for.
Janelle in Hazelhurst, it's your turn. Hi, Janelle.
Hi. We just got a heated bird bath,
yeah,
and we've had it out for about 4 days, and we can't seem to attract any birds to it. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, anybody want to, Noel, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, it's good to have it near cover where birds can come down from a spruce tree or conifer of some kind and visit it and feel a little secure. It's really tough to have it way out in the open. Plus, you maybe put a stone in the middle of it, something to perch on, just a couple of suggestions, I guess. Sometimes it just takes time. Maybe there's other water in the area that the birds are using. Do you have a bird feeders with birds coming into the feeders?
Yes, and we've actually put seed all around the bird bath, too, to try to get them to go there, and we did put a few stones in it. But it's been about 4 days, and they just don't seem to be attracted to it yet.
Well, just give it some time, and you know, when they I'm sure they can find it. It's nothing great to discover it. So just give it some time, and I would guess that they'll start visiting it.
I bet you within a week. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate the call, Janelle. Lisa in St. Germain, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, I've spent 3 summers here in the Northwoods now, and every spring and summer we hear the call of a bird, and it sounds like a tin slide whistle, mostly in the morning, late afternoon, and one time we heard it at night when we were sitting around the bonfire, and I have no idea what it is.
A tin slide whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, Craig?
Boy, I have to say I'm stumped on that one, Larry. Can you do the tin slide whistle, Lisa?
Oh, I don't think so.
Huh. Noel, any ideas?
I'm not even sure what a 10-slide whistle sounds like is my problem, I guess.
Well, a slide whistle with a real tinny sound to it.
So it starts high and goes low, or?
Yeah, I guess it would.
What time of day do you hear it, or what kind of habitats do you have around your house?
Well, we're in the deep woods.
Okay.
Deep in the woods. And mostly in the morning, late afternoon or early evening. And one time we were sitting around the bonfire and we heard it after dark. And it's very unusual. And my daughter, in fact, bought me a book for Christmas with the bird calls where you can punch in the number of the page and you can hear the bird calls. And I've been through every single page and cannot find that bird call.
You know, last night at a family event for New Year's Eve, my daughter got a slide whistle, but we didn't try it out. So I don't, and I can't whistle very well. So maybe somebody else will have. Stay listening, Lisa. Somebody else might have some ideas.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah.
In the evening or night, you can often hear a screech owl, which kind of has a whinny call that I call that goes down the scale. I know there's some birders out this morning trying for screech owls and heard them. We had them, two different ones, singing at our house after dark about 3 or 4 days ago, so that might be a possibility.
Craig, we've got a call from Sharon in southeastern Minnesota. Southeastern Minnesota. She wants to know if a broad-winged hawk usually overwinters in the southeastern Minnesota area.
Actually, no, not typically. Now, you can never rule anything out with birds. They sometimes do some pretty remarkable things. But more often than not, broadwings are considered to be long-distance neotropical migrants, and they actually winter in the Andes of northern South America.
Oh.
So they go quite a ways. It would be unusual to see a broadwing here at this time of year.
Yeah.
Maybe think about a red-shouldered. They're about the same size. Both of them have barring on the tail, the reddish in the chest area. So look up red-shouldered hawk in the field guide and think about that.
All right. Patricia in Marshfield, it's your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, about 2 or 3 years ago, I'd gotten a finch, a yellow finch. It was a baby, and it had a broken wing. And I put it in the cage, and I've been feeding it and watering it ever since. So I really don't know what to do with this bird. I mean, I don't want to keep it in this cage forever, but I'll open it in the summer. I keep the cage outside, and it won't leave. But I don't think it can fly anymore, but I just don't know what to do with it.
Craig?
Well, I think the best thing you can do is try to get that bird to a licensed rehabber. They're a bird rehabilitator. They have the necessary permits to hold a species like that, and they are well equipped to actually be able to take care of it and provide long-term care, or perhaps transfer it to a facility that can provide long-term care. If I can get your number after the show or sometime, Larry, if you can give me Patricia's number, I can call you later this week and try to determine where your closest local bird rehabilitator is.
Patricia, we'll put you on hold, and Keisha will come on and get your number, and she'll pass it along to Craig, okay?
Thank you.
Well, hang on there. We'll put you on hold. And let's go to Jude and Ellison Bay next. Jude, hi.
Hi, good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Caller before last, she wanted to know what the bird that sounded like the sliding penny whistle. I think it's a vireo. It's got a very unusual high-low call. It almost sounds like it's going in a spiral.
Ah.
It goes something like that.
Oh, you mean a vireo?
A vireo.
A vireo.
No, a vireo.
No, that's a vireo.
It's a thrush.
Right.
Yeah. That's it. Happy New Year.
All right. Happy New Year. What do you think, guys? Could be, eh?
Could very well be.
Yeah, it's got a beautiful ethereal descending call. Actually, I think that perhaps it was Jude that just did it, and it's a bird that everyone loves to hear, and it really is a stopper. As you're walking through the woods and you hear a vireo, you just have to stop and enjoy it. It's terrific, and they're not uncommon in central and northern Wisconsin, so it certainly could be that.
And they're definitely sing late into the afternoon, early evening.
Yep. All right. So that's a pretty good guess there. Let's go to David in Bayfield next. David, hi.
Hi. Thanks for this opportunity, guys.
Sure.
Appreciate your time. I represent, I'm on the board for the Living Forest Cooperative out of Ashland, and we have about 160 members and 16,000 acres that we manage. And one of our major concerns is deer browse and the change in the ecology of the forest because of the high number of deer. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the negative effect of deer browse on birds.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Craig, what do you think?
There's no doubt that over-browse by deer have a tremendous impact on bird reproductive ability. There have been excellent studies that have come out of both Pennsylvania and Ohio that have correlated extremely high deer numbers with decreased reproductive success for a number of woodland species which breed in the big forests of Ohio and Pennsylvania. We know that excessive deer numbers are an issue in Wisconsin from a management standpoint, not only in terms of their direct ecological impacts, but also in terms of forest regeneration. And certainly we have concerns as it relates to the ability of our ability to maintain birds on the landscape. So right on in terms of your observations that there are impacts, and that's why we're working, the Department of Natural Resources is working very hard with the hunting community to try to get deer down to manageable numbers.
Yeah, and if you, I've had the opportunity to visit some exclosures in some of the northern Wisconsin forests that have been put in, some I think by the DNR itself and by native groups, and it is absolutely amazing. An exclosure is a fenced-in area that nothing can get into, and it's usually a small area, and the difference between the land inside the exclosure and outside is unbelievable.
I agree, Larry, and you've talked about the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. One of the committees that we have with WBC is an issues committee, and we have written a number of fact sheets, and one of the fact sheets that's in preparation right now is the impact of deer on birds. And as Craig mentioned, as you mentioned, they definitely have an impact, and it's something we really need to look at and decide how we can do a better job of managing our deer herd numbers so they don't have such a negative impact on some of our plant communities.
Yeah. Peg in Rice Lake, it's your turn now. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. I hear you've already got an answer for your sliding tin whistle, but if it isn't a veery, because a veery, the way you played it, sounds so musical. I was a couple years ago hearing a tin whistle, I called it. Not a sliding. I don't know what a sliding sounds like. And I just called it a tin whistle. It was repeated. It was all the time. It was several days. I finally saw a hawk soaring overhead, and I kind of thought maybe it was a young one at the age when they come out and they say, hey, where's my breakfast? Why are you all hiding? You know. And they kind of make stupid noises so everybody flies away and they never do get breakfast until they learn to shut up a little. Anyway, I thought maybe that could be it. And there was a little funny follow-up to that story. Have you got time for
sure.
it?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, after a number of days, I began to hear it. I was still hearing it, but it sounded sick. I thought, oh, no, something's happened to it. It's hurt. It's sick. I'm walking around. I live in the woods, looking in trees and practically breaking my neck and falling logs and roots. And I'm sure I'm going to see a sick hawk up there somewhere. And finally, after maybe a week, I found the source of this sick-sounding tin whistle. It was a blue jay trying to imitate a hawk.
Ah, you think so?
Well, this was the second one. The original one was, I'm sure, a hawk and maybe a young one. Do they do that when they're young?
Yes, great horned owls, once they're fledged out of the nest, they beg for food, and they do have quite a screech call. And as you mentioned, blue jays really have a great repertoire of sounds, and I'm continually fooled sometimes until I really listen closely. And you can usually tell if they're a blue jay, but boy, on first blush, they can sound like a hawk and a number of other species.
Yeah, I have also been duped by mischievous blue jays on a couple of occasions, doing splendid imitations of red-shouldered hawks. So they really do have talent in terms of their ability to mimic other birds.
Thanks again for calling. Tom and O'Connor, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Thanks so much for your program. I've just been out the last couple of days fishing for steelhead on some of the open reaches of the Oconto River, and a fishing partner of mine is a belted kingfisher. I've seen him on 2 days now, and he's out there enjoying himself around the open water. Just kind of wondering how commonly they stay this far north in the state throughout the winter.
Belted kingfisher. Noel, comment?
Well, they're not at all common, but we always do have a few. And as you mentioned, where there's open water of sufficient size and good fish populations, that they will hang around in the wintertime. I know in the Kickapoo count down in Monroe, Vernon County, there's quite a few streams that are open. We looked and looked and looked and couldn't find one. Then on the way home, we were driving Highway 33, came through Hillsboro, and there was a belted kingfisher on a wire. Of course, it was outside our Christmas count area, and we couldn't count it. But they turn up occasionally on Christmas bird counts, and it's always one of the birds that we really work hard to try to find. And the Oconto River would definitely be a good place to find one overwintering.
Oh, that must have been fun to have that as a fishing partner, Tom.
Yeah, it was fun to see them. Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. And Bob and Gilman, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Morning.
We didn't have any brown thrashers up here at all at my place this last summer, and we've usually had two or three pair in the yard. And I'm in rural, and just wondering if that's common that the brown thrashers weren't around this last summer.
Craig?
Well, it's hard to predict if any given species of bird will show up in an area in a given year. Birds have a tendency to be unpredictable in their occurrences, and so the fact that you've had thrashers and suddenly don't for 1 year is not all that unusual, perhaps a bit more disconcerting if they never show up again. Thrashers are a shrub-associated species that has been declining throughout its range in eastern North America, and it's within an assemblage of species that use early successional habitats, real shrubby stuff. And that amount of shrub habitat isn't as extensive as it once was on the landscape, and as a result, those birds as a group are declining in numbers. Most of them are of conservation concern throughout their breeding ranges in eastern North America, and certainly the thrasher is one of those. It's one of my favorite birds. It's a large, splendid bird, just beautiful, and has a tremendous vocal repertoire. So I would hope that perhaps they'll return next year for you.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Craig Thompson of La Crosse chairs the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative International Committee and is Regional Land Program Supervisor with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's one of our guests. The other, Noel Cutright of Wausaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. He's also senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. If you would like to join in with a question, we have an open line. We'll get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to the phones, I wanted to turn to Craig Thompson for just a minute. Craig, one of the programs that you are going to be working on in 2008, that's the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, is the golden-winged warbler. What's the initiative going to do to help in the conservation effort to save that bird?
I appreciate you asking about that, Larry. We're really excited about this. We are initiating a campaign, starting today, in fact, called the Wisconsin Golden-winged Warbler Campaign. And as just a bit of background, Wisconsin is host to 25% of the world's breeding population of golden-winged warblers. But no other species of bird has a higher percentage of its breeding population in this state. And what that means is we have an enormous stewardship responsibility for the species, and that translates into a tremendous conservation opportunity. What we're doing via the campaign is embracing an approach that's called full life cycle management. So we're looking at addressing the needs on the breeding grounds for the birds, ensuring that there are migratory stopover sites, and specifically within the context of this campaign, we're focusing on the birds' wintering ground needs. This is the first statewide campaign in the nation to use a flagship species as a catalyst for conservation, and we believe it's going to be a very successful model that will ultimately be emulated by other states. And the essence of the campaign is to advance conservation of key wintering areas for the golden-winged warbler. Now, this is a splendid-looking little wood warbler that nests in central and northern Wisconsin and migrates all the way down to Central and South America to winter in oak-dominated montane forests from southern Nicaragua down through Colombia. The elevation that this bird winters at it has a climate that's very cool with rich volcanic soils, and it's an area that in general is very conducive to agriculture. And as a result, the area has been tremendously impacted by a variety of activities, all of which result in clearing to some degree. So we know that less than 10% of the forests that this bird depends on are still extant, that is, they still exist. Now, what we're trying to do is raise $50,000 over the course of the next 2 years to train our, help fund our partners in Latin America to set aside, to identify and to set aside areas that are critical for the golden-winged warbler over winter survival. We want to make sure that we have good numbers of golden wings coming back every year to Wisconsin just because they're part of our landscape, and again, we have this tremendous stewardship responsibility for them.
And how are you going to be raising that money?
Well, we're actually soliciting individuals and organizations and entities, asking them to be generous and to support, again, what is considered to be a species that's emblematic of bird conservation in Wisconsin. I would encourage listeners to go to the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative website. It's www.wisconsinbirds.org. And look in the lower right-hand corner and click on the golden wing link, and you'll get a beautiful fact sheet with spectacular pictures of the bird and some habitat in Colombia that really summarizes what we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it. This is a species that continentally is of tremendous conservation concern because of precipitous declines in its population. And we know, Larry, if we can protect golden wing habitat in Latin America, and again, we have to take a hemispheric approach to conservation for these birds which migrate back and forth every year, it will not only benefit golden wings, but it's going to benefit 14 other species of conservation concern in Wisconsin, which winter in the same habitat that golden wings winter in. And we also know that with the myriad species that occur in Latin America, there are going to be a host of, in fact, 31 globally endangered species will benefit from this campaign as well. So it really leverages conservation dollars to give us a big bang for the buck.
I just went to your website as you were talking. It's a really nice picture of a golden wing right on the on that site. It is a beautiful bird. It really is. John in Germantown, it's your turn. John, hello.
Hello, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm on my speakerphone with my sister, and we were just listening to your program on our way down to a store in Milwaukee. And I've had a first time ever since I lived where I'm at for 11 years, a red-headed woodpecker. At my house this past fall. I don't know if they migrate, but Donny woodpeckers and just about every kind of bird you can think of. And I found, I was looking out my kitchen window where I have a feeder on a white cedar, and there were no birds except for one fledgling bird, and it was on the feeder, and it would not move. And I looked up in the tree, I saw movement. And what it was is there's a red-tailed hawk up in the tree and moving around, trying to get that bird to move, but that bird would not move. It was underneath the squirrel protector, so it's kind of interesting. But you're talking about the kingfisher. My sister lives on the Menominee River in Menominee Falls, and the ice has opened up on the river, and she's spotted a kingfisher flying up and down the river recently.
Yeah. Is that common, though?
Yeah, we talked about kingfishers, and your red tails will visit feeders. They're not real adept at catching the smaller birds. They're more targeted to mammals and maybe a little bit larger species out in more open areas. So they will visit feeder situations, but not as common as coopers and sharpshins, as we talked about. You mentioned red-headed woodpeckers. Most of the red-headed woodpeckers, and of course, it's a species that's declining in Wisconsin, do migrate out of the state. Even though there's a few that stay in Wisconsin, we saw a couple of young birds. The young birds don't have a red head yet. They'll still have a dark head this time of year. So there can kind of be fooling because you don't see any red on it all. We had two on our Cassville Christmas bird count, but they're not common in the state, but a few do overwinter.
Hmm. All right. Thanks, John. Mike in Seneca has something, I think, also related to redheaded. So, Mike?
Yes, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Say, I've got something kind of unusual here. I've got a large feeder. I get most of the birds, the species in southwest Wisconsin, but on the redheaded variety, I last year had four that frequented my bird feeder, and I would like to imitate the sound they make, and I would like to know if this is unique to the male or female, or if it's something announcing themselves. As soon as I get out and I start messing with the feeder, they're in the trees and they're going like. But this year, that's the sound this one lone one makes. The other ones disappeared, and the previous ones were kind of like a. Does that make sense?
Well, let's see. Let's see, Craig. Does that make sense?
Well, it does make sense, and there's a possibility, Mike, that you might have two different species there. There's a bird called a red-bellied woodpecker, which is a frequent visitor to bird feeders, and they also have a red head. The red belly is almost a bit of a misnomer. If you actually had the bird in hand, it's got a very faint orangey-red wash on its belly, very difficult to see as a diagnostic field characteristic, in fact, almost impossible. And I routinely have bird discussions with people who say, oh, my gosh, I had a red-headed woodpecker, when it's actually a red-bellied. And the calls that you are imitating kind of suggest to me that perhaps you have red-bellied woodpeckers, although you...
Oh.
If the bird has an entirely bright red head, and when it flies away you see striking black and white wings, then you have red-headed woodpeckers. If the bird you see has kind of an orangey-red on the back of its head, and it has black and white, narrow black and white barring on its back and its wings, and what you have is a red-bellied woodpecker. Their calls are not all that different, so it's a little bit tough for me without actually hearing the bird call to know, but there's a possibility you might be dealing with one or two of those species.
Okay.
Can I ask one more
thing?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, these were the only ones I get are the ones with the red over the top of the head, and depending on their age, when they're real young, they don't have any red, and they're all gray looking, almost like a catbird, but except for the polka dots. But these, well, let's put it this way: I've had full red-headed woodpeckers down to the almost to the wing. They're
yeah.
really bright red. I haven't seen one of them for a while, like two years. But these just have the crown of the head. They're either orangey-red or, in some cases, real red, but it doesn't go past, like, around the eyes and around
yeah.
down to the bottom of the head. So maybe
yeah.
your diagnosis is correct. Maybe it's not what I think they are.
Yeah, I suspect, Mike, that you're dealing with red-bellied woodpeckers, and if you just pull out your field guide and take a look, that should confirm it for you. That beak, beak, beak call that you were referring to is actually an alarm call. So when you go out to fill the feeder, they think, oh, my goodness, there's a big bipedal predator out in our feeder. And they're warning
with a red stocking cap on.
With a red stocking cap on, an imposing feeder. And they're a little bit concerned, and so that's an alarm call. That other, that more like that that you hear is a typical red-bellied call that you can hear throughout the season.
Right.
In other words, don't try to imitate this clucking sound.
Well, and don't mess with their suet feeder. They might decide to get tough with you.
All right. Mike, thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. All right. Carl in Sheboygan, we'll go to you next. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
I just wanted to mention to Noel and Craig an interesting sighting a group of us birders had this morning. We're out doing a New Year's Day count, and we happened upon a Townsend solitaire at Colorado State Park near Sheboygan, and that's sort of unusual, we realized. We just wondered how common is that in Wisconsin? And
Noel, how common? We got
Well, I'm jealous right now. I may be leaving your program, Larry. I had breakfast with Carl this morning, and my son is with that group. And Townsend solitaire is a species that shows up every winter in Wisconsin and in low numbers. It's really a western species. It's a thrush species, feeds on primarily berries and other fruit when they visit Wisconsin in the wintertime. And we always get a few. The best place to find them is over at Devil's Lake State Park, where they feed on the juniper berries up on those hillsides and cliffs. But finding one, and like I say, I may be cutting this program short, Larry.
There were indeed some juniper there at the park, and we suspect that that's indeed what this bird was feeding on. Noel would probably also be interested to know that we had a red-throated loon out on the lake while we were there as well. So it's been a pretty good morning so far.
I'll be calling you on your cell phone after the program, Carl.
Thanks a lot for calling. Craig Thompson of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Noel Cutright, historian for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, our guests here till 12:30 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy New Year, everyone. Larry Mueller here, and we're taking a look at birds and bird conservation efforts in Wisconsin now with Craig Thompson of La Crosse, a regional land program supervisor with the Wisconsin DNR. He also chairs the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative International Committee, and Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, the senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Pleased to have them along, and certainly if you want to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's take a call from Jackie. Jackie in Milwaukee. Hello, Jackie. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Only Larry could go to Paris and get food poisoning. I now know what Noel Cutright looks like, a good picture in the We Energies publication. But my question is, I've fed birds for many years, and I have a bunch of mallards that come in winter. This is the first time I have ever, unless it's happened before, seen a mallard catch a tiny mouse and eat it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It swung it around in the air, it bit it, it beat it up, and it, the last I saw, it was, the mouse was disappearing. It was a tiny one, but I didn't know that they would do things. I mean, bugs, yes, but never a mouse.
Well, Noel, did you ever see a mallard take a mouse?
No, I haven't. Hi, Jackie. Of course, this is why we enjoy watching birds, as I've talked about before, because we're always seeing something that we don't anticipate, and sometimes it's really noteworthy that, you know, other birders are interested in hearing about. Many of our birds are pretty opportunistic, and they will take opportunities to cash in on some of the protein or some of the calories they can capture like this. So I guess it doesn't surprise me, even though I haven't seen it, and I'm sure this is pretty a very uncommon observation to make, and it's great you were able to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another big surprise for Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, thanks, Jackie. Thanks for calling.
And perhaps a big surprise for the duck hunters if, in fact, ducks are becoming predatory.
Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer now. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I have a few. I don't think I'll be able to cover it all, but I was at Bigfoot Beach State Park this past July, and one day a little girl, there was several families camping and occupying a large area, about maybe five sites, and she was carrying a little bird around, and I talked with her for about 50 minutes. She was like about 6 years old, and the bird looked to me like a baby hawk, and then I told her if she put it by the tree, the mother might come back for it, and then I realized, well, that might not be a good idea because there were so many children running around. And she said, yeah, we already did that with one, and it got killed. And so she brought me over to it, and it was identical. And then all day I could hear a hawk. And so I looked in my bird book, and that's when I realized the distinguishing characteristics between these two hawks, the red-tailed hawk, and I can't remember what the other one was. But one goes, one just, like, escalates. It's like, and the other one is like an up, more like up and down, you know, I can't even
can't do that one.
But that, so that was, and then I at the like about 4 hours later, everybody was leaving, and they had put it in a. I gave them a shoebox for it, and they didn't use it, and they ended up putting it like behind a building there, and so I brought it down to the lady at the. At the check, you know, the check-in, and she, it was so busy. She, I think the bird just ended up dying, but we tried feeding it with like a straw, and it was, we found some like ant eggs, and he was actually eating it. So that was like one. I wondered if you could tell me what the baby hawks look like. And then also I was out at Horicon Marsh, and they said they have pelicans out there. Can you comment on that?
Oh, yeah. Lots of pelicans there. But, Craig, I want to talk about baby hawks first.
Well, it's tough to know exactly what species you're dealing with based on the calls that you had imitated. I think the one that goes, the monosyllabic call that goes up is probably a red tail. The other one might be a red-shouldered, which has a little bit more rhythm to its call. And, again, without seeing the bird, it's tough to know. I think your suggestion that the bird gets put in a spot where the adult can return and take care of it is the best one. Sometimes that just doesn't happen. And in those instances where it's impossible to put the bird in a relatively secure situation where the adults will return, and they do return, they're very good about that, then the best thing to do is to try to find a local bird rehabilitator or a wildlife rehabilitator to get that critter to, so they can provide the proper care. Very tough to take care of wildlife without knowing exactly what their nutritional needs are and what their behavioral idiosyncrasies are.
Yeah, absolutely. Deb, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Gene and Grand Chute, it's your turn. Hi, Gene.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple of things I'd like to talk about, and one of them is last Saturday morning about 8:30 a.m. I looked out in our yard, and we have a big forsythia bush near the back of the yard, and I thought I saw a large cat sitting there. And it didn't quite look like a cat. It was very plump and fluffed up. And all of a sudden, it sort of shook itself a little bit, and I realized it had wings. And it was staring into this bush, and a short time later, it started to fly away, and I realized it was an owl. But it just looked so much like a cat sitting upright. And I'm wondering if it was a short-eared owl, because I couldn't see any large ears on it, and I don't think it was big enough to be a great horned. But after it left, we realized there was a little red squirrel in that forsythia bush. And I think that's what had brought him down, and the squirrel stayed in there the longest time before it dared come out again.
Noel, what do you think?
Well, short-eared owls are really birds of the open grassland, open habitat area. They probably would not come in and around your house at all. It's probably more likely to be a barred owl. Barred owls also do not have any feather tufts or what we call as ears on owls. So I'm guessing that's what it was. A red squirrel would be the right-sized mammal that a barred owl would take, so that's what I'm suggesting.
Yep.
And one comment before we forget Deborah's other question about pelicans.
Thank you for
that. Yeah, we definitely have white pelicans now breeding in Wisconsin. They first started showing up in the late 90s, and now they're breeding in a few spots. And as the population continues to build, as we talk about Kirtland's warblers, as we have new birds, and as the population increases, they're going to be looking for new areas to breed in. I would expect them to start breeding along the Mississippi River and other places other than Horicon and the islands off Green Bay. So it's definitely a species to keep an eye open for come springtime.
Yep, absolutely.
An interesting prediction on Noel's part, because we had for the first year now documentation of breeding pelicans on the Mississippi River, so it has in fact happened.
We've been suspecting that they did, but glad to hear that they are.
Yep, absolutely. Wendy in Delafield, your turn now. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
I've had an interesting bird at my feeder the last three winters. I've had a Carolina wren, and it's obviously a wren. It's bigger than a house wren, and it has a broad white eye band.
Uh-huh.
And kind of a buffy-colored belly. And he's been coming in my feeder and particularly eating the peanut pieces. But he's been here 3 winters in a row now. The first time I saw him, I was really shocked. And he just, I see him pretty well every morning when I put the bird feed out on the platform feeder. There he is. And I thought it was pretty unusual in this area.
Noel, that's pretty unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. The Carolina wrens are more of a southern species. We always have a few, and they tend to build up in numbers and populations, and we have a real tough winter comes along and sets the population back, and then they'll slowly recover again. That there's been more Carolina wrens in the Wisconsin over the last couple of years. I didn't see one in 2007 until the Cassville count. My son and I found two Carolina wrens along the bluffs there along the Mississippi on Sunday. Just getting the emails here on the computer network, and some a gal reports one from Iowa County that's been coming to her feeder, and that was kind of her first great bird here in 2008. So to have it 3 years in a row, that's a terrific bird. They're a great songster. I grew up with them in southern Ohio. It's nice to have, and peanuts would definitely be a good food to have out for Carolina wren. So it's a good sighting. It's a good species, and hope you continue to enjoy it for more winters.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it, Wendy. Thank you. And Clyde in Denmark, it's your turn. Hi, Clyde.
Hi. We had kind of an unusual sighting at our feeder here in the mid part of December for 3 days. We had a female varied thrush. According to the Peterson guide anywhere, it looked just exactly like her. And she was eating the seeds off of the ground that the other birds had spilled, and just never seen one before. And kind of a little bigger than a robin, and didn't seem to be scared too much when we went to feed the birds, but she stayed for about 3 days.
That's a cool sighting.
Yeah, it is, and if I can jump in here and kind of zip out Craig a little bit. Yeah, it's like the Townsend solitaire that was just reported from Kohler Andry. We do have a few varied thrushes that seem to show up every year. Again, it's a thrush, as the name implies. And it's a western species, somewhat similar looking to a robin. We usually get males in the state, but there was a female reported earlier in this year. In fact, over in Wausau, in the same subdivision, there has been a Townsend solitaire and a varied thrush seen. And as the caller mentioned, they do like to feed on seeds and also berries. So it's a good sighting, and I hope you can keep it around.
Yep, absolutely. Gene and Grand Chute, back to you.
Yeah, back to me, Larry. You cut me off before I could say that we do have open fields behind our house, and I didn't think it was a barred owl. It seemed a little different to that, and could it possibly have been a short-eared owl? And I wanted to say something about bird baths, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, should I go ahead with the bird bath thing?
Yeah, go ahead with the bird bath, Gene.
Yeah, I have a heated bird bath, and it's in a slightly sheltered spot. It has plenty of tree close to it for the birds to perch in, and it's also close to the feeders. And it's like Grand Central Station out there. And the funniest thing is to see the morning doves sometimes just at the late in the afternoon. This thing's about 15 inches across, and I've seen as many as 10 morning doves stuff themselves in and sit in it. But during the day, it's finches, cardinals, morning doves, blue jay. Everything is just constantly in and out.
Oh.
So I think if she would provide some trees to, you know, put it near a tree and near the feeders, she'll get birds.
Yeah. But your comment about the open fields, Craig, what do you think?
Well, again, you can never rule out the possibility that birds behave in irregular ways. So it is possible that Gene had a short-eared owl. I don't know, Gene, if you can recall exactly what the bird looked like, but an excellent way to distinguish between short-eared and barred-eared owls is their eye color. Barred owls have dark eyes. Short-eared owls have bright yellow eyes.
It had its back to me the whole time.
Oh, okay.
And it just looked like a cat sitting there.
Yeah.
And it looked like there might have been a little bit of knobs on the top of the head when it moved its head.
Yeah, but Noel's suggestion that it could have been a barred owl is a very good one. They're typically found more frequently in suburbanized habitats, or at least on the fringes of those, than our short-eared owls.
This was 8:30 a.m.
Okay, yeah. And just in regard to the bird bath comment. We have a heated bird bath out in our yard, and it is a parade of birds all day long. For anyone who's really interested in attracting birds in the winter, certainly feeders, cover, and a heated bird bath are an unbeatable combination.
Yep.
Now, typically, short-eared owls hunt on the wing, meaning they course low over the ground in grassland open areas, looking primarily for meadow voles, their primary prey, and then they'll when they find one, they'll go down for it, very much like a harrier or a marsh hawk. And sitting and trying to catch a red squirrel in a shrub like a forsythia, as Craig says, we had mouse eating mallards before. who's to say for sure? But that would not be typical behavior for a short-eared.
It didn't stay long. It was just down and then off again.
Off again. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Dick in Burlington, I believe, is next. Dick, hi to you.
Hey, hi. Thank you. I observed some behavior several years ago that's stuck in my mind. Springtime. We have a place in a small lake, central Wisconsin. The loons, common loons, never nest there, but they sit there as they migrate on occasion. And on a warm April day, I could hear a goose, a real agitated, constant calling of a Canadian goose, enough that I stopped my work and watched it. And it was circling. It was quite high, way out of shooting range, real high, out in the middle of this little 70-acre lake. As I watched that goose, it tucked its wings like a hawk and went into a power dive into the middle of the lake, and it crashed. It crashed right on top of a loon. The loon popped up. The goose swam over to it and with its beak pecked it until it was dead. And I just was—I don't know that that's common behavior, but it always struck me, and I can still see it happening. And my brother and a neighbor saw the same thing when it happened.
Wow.
It wasn't nesting. It was in the middle of the lake. It was just, I thought, quite unusual behavior that I so clearly could observe happen.
Craig?
All I can say is wow to that, too. This is starting the new year with some truly amazing bird stories. I have no explanation for that other than that was a remarkable sighting.
And that loon was dead because I watched it for a while through the binoculars just floating on the water.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well.
my second comment that I probably shouldn't be admitting to here, but a few weeks ago, or just at the very end of fall, I unfortunately found a freshly killed hawk. It's a marsh or a harrier hawk. It's the kind of the brownish one, I believe. I don't know if that's the male or the female.
The female or a young bird.
It was under my window, dead, but it had just must have died, and I just felt like I couldn't leave it there, and I put it in a Ziploc bag and put it in my freezer, and I'm sure I'm breaking some laws doing that. But is there someone who I can give that to, or a school, or a DNR, or should I just not even be admitting to this and dispose of it the way I normally would?
Well, Dick, I would suggest that if it's a good specimen, that you're going to want to contact your local conservation warden and hand the bird over. It is technically illegal to be in possession of these birds without the appropriate permit.
Right.
And the wardens are very careful about who they provide permits to, typically only educational institutions,
right,
or rehabilitators.
And that would be my thought. I don't even want it, but I would even pay to mount it to give it to a school.
Yeah, that'd be great. But what you want to do is facilitate that transaction through a warden so you make sure you're completely above board in terms of the legalities of handling that critter.
You might want to try the folks down at Bong. They do have mallard specimens there and a little bit of a nature center at their headquarters at the Bong State Recreation Area near Burlington.
Yep, that's a good idea. All right. Good luck, Dick. Thank you very much for calling. Karen in Portage, it's your turn. Hi, Karen.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Comment first, pileated woodpeckers. I've got a farm on the river, and I don't know if they have a super hearing or smell, but the one that resides down in the bayous came all the way up by the house, and I watched him for an afternoon riddle my decrepit catalpa tree with holes, and that they don't get a headache, I can't believe. Peanuts. I have red-breasted nuthatches along with a few million other kinds of birds, but they will come and sit, a couple of them, right on the tree. I've got a short tree next to the deck that I have the bird feeders off of, and sit there and wait for me to put a half a peanut first in the feeder, which are old satellite dishes, and he will come down, take that peanut, and fly off. And I'm you know, everybody goes nuts over peanuts. And I'm wondering, where is the sensibility in feeding peanuts to birds? Because, you know, I don't know of any place where they find wild roasted peanuts.
No?
Well, they will definitely feed on nuts, other kinds of nuts. I mean, they will, you know, blue jays very often. We're seeing good numbers of blue jays this winter because we had a good acorn crop probably. So they can recognize foods that are nutritious for them and contain a lot of calories, even though they're not a native species to them. And how they learn this, yeah, that's a good question. You know, how does a bird learn to eat peanut butter, which was a common feed that I fed when I was a kid growing up in southern Ohio? You don't see it much anymore just because of the expense of peanut butter, but peanuts are highly nutritious, a lot of calories in there, high energy content, and birds certainly learn somehow through experimentation, maybe watching squirrels eat them, who knows, but they certainly learn to recognize foods that are good for them.
And just to comment about the pileated woodpeckers, no birds actually care and have a good sense of smell with the exception of vultures, and I think the reason they have a good sense of smell is pretty obvious, to help them find their source of food. So what that pileate is probably keying in on is a big old rotting tree, because they've learned via experience that those trees have the prey that they like, and they key in on carpenter ants and carpenter ant larvae. And so, you know, they're pecking away, and in regard to the headache comment, you'd think that they would get a splitting migraine, but the anatomical assessments that have been done of woodpeckers indicate that they have a very specialized and strong musculature in their neck and around their head that actually buffers them from all of that pecking that they're doing. So they're very well adapted to peck away all day long to make sure that they get the food that they need to get them through the winter.
Thanks, Karen. Appreciate the call. Levina in Poinette is next. Hi, Levina.
Hello there. Maybe a little, is the towhee that has that sliding scale noise, voice.
A towhee. What do you think about a towhee as the sliding whistle scale, the tin whistle scale that we heard about earlier?
Well, they do have a high pitch, and then they go down a little bit when they're singing.
The eastern towhees typically have two different calls. One, the mnemonic for their breeding call, that they use to advertise for females, and for males is something along the lines of "drink your tea." And I don't do it very well, so I don't expect towhees to be flocking to the office here. But they also have something that's not a song but a call, and it's more along the lines of a tinny, whistly shriek that they do a lot of times as they're foraging or if they're alarmed. So there are those two kinds of calls that towhees exhibit. Whether that is akin to a sliding tin whistle or not, I don't know. Perhaps Noel has a different perspective on that.
No,
sounds good, Craig.
All right.
Because we do have some around here.
Yep. Could be. Thank you very much, Levina.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Appreciate the call very much. And guys, boy, I really appreciate you being with us today. Craig, what's that website again for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative?
www.wisconsinbirds.org.
Wisconsinbirds.org, that's right. And Noel, how's the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas doing?
Well, I hope some people found them under their Christmas tree this Christmas, Larry, and the sales have been going good. And, boy, it was fun doing, and it's fun to do monitoring. We need to monitor the populations of our birds, whether it's through breeding bird surveys or through an atlas or through Christmas bird counts. And in February, we have the great backyard bird count coming up in February, so maybe we can talk about that as the winter progresses.
Sounds great. Happy New Year, guys. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Happy New Year, Larry and Noel, and to all your listeners.
Absolutely.
Noel Cutright, of the senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, Craig Thompson of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative and the Department of Natural Resources. And a happy new year to you, and stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.